This is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tijeras, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Colorblind. I'm speaking via phone with Army brat and veteran and author Bernard Lee. Hi, Bernard.
Hello, how are you?
I am well, thank you. I need to explain to our listeners that we are doing an interview via phone because you're on the East Coast and we're also in a pandemic, so we're social distancing. So let's just have a conversation. But oh, I should have said that you're an award-winning author. I saw a mention of a finalist on one of your books. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm writing a book series.
Mm-hmm.
It's called A Look Back in Time,
mm-hmm.
Memoir of a Military Kid in the 50s.
Ah.
The first book in the series takes place in the United States. The second book in the series takes place in Germany. I'm three quarters of the way through book three. The second book, which took place in Germany and talked about the time that my dad was in the service in the 50s in Germany, I won a Best Book Award finalist in the AmericanBookFestival.com contest. I also was nominated for a Top Shelf 2020 Book Award, and I won a 2019 Editor's Choice Giroux Publications Book Club Award. So those three awards were given to the second book in the series about the time that we spent in Germany.
Wow. Congratulations. I am so impressed. That's pretty awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. So talking about being a brat, you were a brat in the 50s and 60s. So where all did you live?
We moved every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Maryland,
mm-hmm.
in the elementary school. I lived in Georgia,
mm-hmm.
in middle school, and I lived in Texas and Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
in middle school, and I went to high school in Germany,
mm-hmm.
Nuremberg, Germany, and high school in Lawton, Oklahoma, the artillery center for the United States in the 60s.
So you graduated from Lawton then?
Yes, from Lawton Senior High School.
Okay.
In 1963.
Okay. I ask all of our guests this. Did you have a favorite and a least favorite assignment? Which was your favorite? Which was your least favorite?
My favorite assignment was Germany.
Uh-huh.
I really loved the culture. I loved the people.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the teenagers that I spent time with there.
Mm-hmm.
I loved how much I learned about the rest of the world the time that we were there. I didn't have a least favorite, but my second most favorite,
mm-hmm.
was the time I spent in Oklahoma. We did two tours in Oklahoma. So my dad was there for two tours. So I finally got to meet some people who I was able to keep in contact with even up to today.
Well, wow. You know, I'm thinking about, you mentioned school, elementary, middle, high school. As I understand it, you attended schools before schools were desegregated. So they were still segregated in your early years. What was that like?
Yes, I did attend school. The desegregation order occurred from the Supreme Court in 1954,
mm-hmm.
and I attended school in Augusta, Georgia, when my dad was deployed at Fort Gordon in 1955. I have an interesting story about that. We lived on post,
uh-huh.
and we lived in a four-unit building. Downstairs on the left was an Italian family.
Mm-hmm.
Downstairs on the right was an Irish family. Upstairs on the left was a Hispanic family. And we lived in the fourth unit upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
We played together. We played sports together. We played marbles together. We had races that we ran together.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of fun in the summer. When it came time to go to school, my sister and I, Bernadine, who was 1 year younger than myself, we went to the bus stop where all the other kids were gathering to go.
Mm-hmm.
When we got to the bus stop, a fellow asked me, "What are you doing here?" I said, "We're here to go to school." She says, this isn't your bus stop. I was taken back. I said, what do you mean? He says, your bus stop is down there. And he pointed a block away. He said, by the way, your bus is leaving. My sister and I took our bags. We ran to catch the bus. They stopped the bus for us. Mm-hmm. We got on the bus. We rode off the post.
Mm-hmm.
We rode cross town. We rode into the farmland in Georgia, mm-hmm. into a large field, cornfield, mm-hmm. and a big clearing in the cornfield. There was the most beautiful school I'd ever seen in my life. It had its own auditorium. Mm-hmm. It had its own gymnasium. Mm-hmm. It had its own ball field. But it was separate in Georgia in 1955.
So was that school for only African American children?
It was only for African Americans, whether you lived on post or off post.
So how did you feel about that? You weren't going to go to school with all your friends.
It was a disappointment initially.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was, when we came back from school that day, we got off at our bus stop. Our friends got off at their bus stop. We both ran toward each other, linked arms, and walked back to our homes, telling each other about our day. So on post, we were together. Off post, we went to different schools in 1955.
Wow. So you talked about middle school, I think, in Texas. Was it segregated schools then? Or tell us about El Paso, what it was like living there. Did you go to school on post?
We moved to El Paso when my dad got an assignment working in the Air Defense Artillery Unit. He was one of the first African-American instructors in that unit, working on the Honest John rocket, which at the time was a new invention for the military. When we were there, we went to school on post.
Uh-huh.
We were in the sixth grade. I was in the sixth grade. My sister was in the fifth grade. And we went to school on post.
Mm-hmm.
I recall being in a gym class where the boys and girls were separated. Mm-hmm. And we were having relay races. Mm-hmm. We had four teams. Mm-hmm. And my team and another team were neck and neck at the end of the relay race. I recall running back, following a kid who was ahead of me. And he leaned over his shoulder and said, the last one back is a lazy, and he used the N-word.
Hmm.
I was shocked. I had never had anybody call me that word in any circumstance, and it just took me back. When we got back to the finish line, I don't know why I didn't control my anger, but I didn't. And so I asked him, what did you mean by what you said? And he said, you heard me. And I cocked him in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
He fell to the ground. The other guys standing around asked the instructor, who, by the way, was a sergeant in the military. That was our gym instructor. The sergeant looked at me, and he looked at the kid on the ground, and he said, serves him right. He shouldn't have misspoke. We're all together here. We're all in the military. We're all the same.
You know, brats talk about this concept of being colorblind. Now, this kid saying that to you would make it seem that that isn't altogether true. But what do you think of it when you hear other military brats saying that we are all brats, we were all colorblind, it was only, you know, we were all military together, like your sergeant said?
Well, when the kid got up on the ground, he walked up to me and he said, I'm sorry. We were kids just like kids today, and kids pick up their discrimination signs from people around them, from their relatives, from their parents, from the media. And so my view of colorblindness is, you can be colorblind when you're in a unit all together, for instance, like if you're on the military post,
mm-hmm.
but the minute you go off post into what we call civilian, then you have to abide by the civilian regulations and mores and culture, and that culture is not colorblind. So I found that my brat friends, when we went off post, kind of stayed together with me.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of had my back.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't let anything happen to me because we weren't on post.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that they pretty much held to the fact that we're all together. We're all military kids.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I encountered racism and discrimination on post.
So moving forward, so you went to one school in Georgia off post, and then you were in Texas at school on post, and then you moved to Fort Sill. Did you go to school on post or off post in Fort Sill in your junior high or high school?
Fort Sill was an interesting experience for me.
Uh-huh.
I went to school initially.
Mm-hmm.
At an all-black school, elementary and high school combined. I only went there a half a year in the sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I noted that the school did not have a gymnasium that was large enough for a boys' basketball, but it had a small gymnasium. I also noticed the school did not have any baseball fields. And it didn't have a football field. So when they practiced football, they practiced up near the highway because the highway had nice grass in for all the turnabouts.
Mm-hmm.
And so the football team practiced on the side of the highway. That was the all-black school at that time in Lawton. Then I went in 1957, the next year,
mm-hmm.
to an integrated school, Central Junior High School in Lawton. That school took military kids and civilian kids. We were all together.
Mm-hmm.
That school had all the amenities that the black school did not have. It also had an experience for me that was kind of earth-shaking initially, but I got over it.
Mm-hmm.
I went to class the first day of school, to my English class. I sat in the third seat in the first row, and I waited for the teacher to come in. She came in, she took the roll, and then the very first exercise we had was, who can recite a preposition? How many can you recite? All our hands went up, including mine,
mm-hmm.
and in the next 20 minutes, the teacher asked almost everyone in the class to recite a preposition or two, except me. When that exercise was finished, she looked at me and asked me, why did I have my hand in the air? I told her I wanted to recite the prepositions that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
She told me, you can do that, but you better not repeat any of the ones that have already been given. And if you make a mistake, you sit right down. So I said, okay. I stood up. I began reciting prepositions like into a tree, around a tree, under a tree, through a tree, anything you could do to a tree. It
mm-hmm.
was a game that my mother, my sister, and I played when we traveled from post to post across country. When I got to preposition 26, she said, shut up and sit down. I was shocked.
Wow.
And then what came next was even more shocking. She turned to the class and said, see, class, that's why they will never amount to anything. They are always trying to show off. I was taken back. In fact, I was hurt. I had tried to do the best that I could. I couldn't help it if I knew a lot of prepositions. I went home after school and told my mom about what had happened. She said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. The next day, she went to school that morning.
Mm-hmm.
She met with the assistant principal and the teacher. According to my mom, she asked them, what are you going to do for my son? He's a military kid. He's from the post. I expect him to be treated like all of the other military kids who go to school here. Are you going to be able to do that? The assistant principal assured her that, yes, they could. My teacher came to our room a little late. She began the exercise the same way she had the day before, and she wanted to know who could recite conjunctions. My hand went up, along with all the other hands in the class. I was the fifth person she called. I stood up, I recited 8 conjunctions, and I sat down. My teacher turned to the class and said, "Thank you very much, Bernard. That was very nice." And she went on to the next child in the class. So I was so proud of my mom for having defended me, and I was so proud of her military background that told her that all people should be treated fairly.
You know, I was going to say that your mom sounds like a really strong woman, and I think about some of the times I've had to go into the principal's office and, you know, advocate for my kids, and so she was acting as a mother, but she was also teaching a very valuable lesson to this teacher. So how did the teacher treat you for the rest of the school year?
Well, we had established how things were going to go.
Mm-hmm.
She was going to be watching me carefully, and I was going to be doing my best not to make a mistake.
Mm.
I did all of her lessons. I studied 3 or 4 lessons in advance for her class. I never went to her class unprepared, and I'm glad to say that I learned enough English grammar
mm-hmm.
in my 7th grade teacher's class that I never had to worry about writing
mm-hmm.
and grammar all the way through college.
But was that a lot of pressure put on you as a kid? I mean, it seems like it was pressure you put on yourself to succeed, but did you feel like you had to be held to a higher standard, or you were held to a higher standard?
I had the talk that African-American kids get.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that talk is you have to be 115% better just to be considered.
Mm.
So, yes, it was extra pressure, but I had been prepared for that pressure. My parents had both told me that if you don't work harder than everyone else, you will be ignored. If you don't prepare yourself as well or better, mm-hmm. in fact, than everyone else, then you won't be selected.
Wow.
And I kept that pressure on myself all the way through school.
Wow. So we're going to come back to that in a few minutes, but I wanted to just finish the conversation about your mom. And I wanted to know what it was like for your mom. Did she get involved with military wives clubs on post or on post activities? Were there integrated groups of wives, or what was it like for your mom being a military wife, an African American military wife?
Yes, my mom was a very outgoing person.
Uh-huh.
She's a Christian, mm-hmm. and so she expected everyone that she met to be treated fairly and to treat her fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And so she a number of things that she did to keep herself active.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was she sold Avon products.
Mm.
It was a big fad in the 50s, and it allowed women to get together in parties
mm-hmm.
and share conversation and share experiences and learn a little bit about makeup
mm-hmm.
and beauty aids and maybe purchase a product or two.
Uh-huh.
That took her throughout the community of military wives and even ingratiated her with some of the officers' wives who also wanted to see her product.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom was able to go between being a non-commissioned officer's wife
mm-hmm.
to communicating with and spending time with the officers' wives as well.
You know, as a young officer's wife, I was often invited to go to Avon and Tupperware parties and other products, and I thought I would try to sell some of that stuff myself, and I was a terrible salesperson. It sounds like your mom did pretty well at it.
Yes, she did. And she learned a lot in the course of that. Mm-hmm. She learned that her life was not much harder than the other wives. Mm-hmm. She learned that her husband had his struggles with being deployed and her not knowing where he was. And when her husband was gone, very often some of the other wives' husbands were gone too. And so they could commiserate with each other, they could support each other. And so it was very helpful for her.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you moved a lot. You moved from Maryland and Georgia and Texas and then to Germany. What was it like for your family when you moved? I mean, most of us can commiserate about the long car trips, but it doesn't seem like it would have been so easy for your family back in the, you know, in the 50s and 60s. So how was it like going on a car trip across country moving?
It was very difficult to travel via car if you were African American in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
There was an aid called the Green Book.
Uh-huh.
However, we did not have one at the time when we made our trip across country from Oklahoma to Virginia to mm-hmm. spend some time with our relatives before going on to New York mm-hmm. and then on to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I recall that we stopped at night and we would park, and you could go to the bathroom at night because you had to go out at night, and so it was easier to go outside at night.
Mm-hmm.
We parked on the top of a hill outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and when we woke up in the morning and opened the door to get out of the car, we were about a foot from the side of the mountain, because when we parked that night, we really weren't able to see how close we were to the edge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I also noticed that my dad wasn't in the car.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was there, my sister Bernadine, who's mm-hmm. a year younger than I was,
mm-hmm.
my brother Mercer, and the baby Almanita, who was a couple of months old, was there too. But my dad was missing. I asked Mom, "Where's Dad?" She said he went into town to get us something to eat. Our father didn't know anyone in the town that we were near.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that we were out of supplies,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't want to risk his family not being accepted in town and maybe being in trouble
mm-hmm.
because we asked the wrong person for help. So he went into town by himself.
Wow.
3 hours later, we saw a shadow of a man coming up the hill, far off, and we noticed as he got closer that he had two bundles under his arms. And when he got to the car, we realized that it was our dad and he was okay. And we were thrilled. He had brought back sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
He had found out where to get the food from asking a colored man in town. And colored was what we called each other in the 50s. We were glad that he had returned safely. But that was not the only time
mm-hmm.
that we had to be left on the side of the road while he went to get help, because you couldn't go to the bathroom. You couldn't stay in hotels. And so it could be a long trip across from Oklahoma to Virginia.
Wow. I'm just digesting this. This is so foreign to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners thinking about this. So you didn't have hotels or a restaurant or gas stations like you do now. And so you really had to depend on your good luck and your perseverance to get from point A to point B.
And the other way we did that was we stayed with relatives. And so our closest relative between Oklahoma, there was no close relative between Oklahoma and Virginia.
Mm.
So we had no place we could stop. So the closest place we could stop was Virginia. We had also had relatives in Washington, D.C., and we stopped there too.
So So, you know, now our country is having this national discussion about race and social injustice, and people are really trying to understand the past. I mean, just my listening to your stories and digesting them, we're trying to figure out how to move forward as a united country. What are you seeing in your neck of the woods? You're on the East Coast, in the South. What's going on there in this, you know, in this time in history?
Well, we have the protest in Georgia, here in Atlanta, as they've had in a lot of other cities and in towns in the United States over the last month. We had the Ahmaud Arbery shooting here in Georgia, in Brunswick, Georgia, where a young man was jogging and he was accosted by three gentlemen, all of whom were armed. That's a part of the protest nationwide for African Americans who lose their lives in a confrontation with either policemen or women who are supposed to uphold the law, or vigilantes, like the young man did here in Georgia. So it's difficult at this time because people are tense, people are afraid, and people are wondering what can be done going forward so that we can de-escalate the tension, and so that we can expect to be treated fairly if you're walking through a neighborhood or running through a neighborhood or just driving in your car.
You mentioned that your dad and mom had the talk with you as, you know, a young boy in the 50s and 60s. Did you have similar conversations with your own kids, and if you did, was the focus different or was it the same?
Unfortunately, from the 50s to 2001, it was pretty much the same. You had the talk that said what you had to do when you were pulled over by a policeman, what you should say, not say, what you should do or not do. You also had the talk that said what you should do if you go to a new place where you do not know someone, how you can stay safe. Those are pretty much the same talks. I had those talks with my kids, my grandchildren, and one of them who lives in Washington, D.C., marched for a couple of days when they protested there. And so, unfortunately, we've come a long way, but we still have a ways to go.
So, and speaking of that, then, you also served in the military. Did you experience racism as an adult with fellow military, or maybe not the military, but living off post somewhere?
Yes, I experienced some discrimination living off post, but I'm kind of rather proud to say, and this is not the experience of everyone who's worked in the military or everyone who's lived on a military post, but I found most often that people were least likely to challenge me as an individual human being if they knew that we had something in common. And having in common that you're a military kid or a military brat or a military person, the treatment that you get from your fellow military persons is usually better and usually more predictable than that you might find in the civilian population.
So let's talk about your mom again. Unless you wanted to add anything to this part right here, did you ever talk? I guess I do have another question. Oh, I just love the way I'm like shiny rabbit, you know. Did you ever talk to your dad after you became a service member about advice about what you should do, or, you know, one soldier to another? Did you call him up and ever say, hey, Dad, you know, you did this in the military. What should I do? About any topic, about jobs or PCSs or a situation?
Yes, I did. My dad was very good. Myself and my brother, he advised us. His mantra was never give up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Keep trying. Never give up. Yes, you may get resistance. You may find that it's difficult, but if you never give up, you always have a chance to succeed. My mom had another message for us. Mm-hmm. She said, you are just as good as everyone else, and never forget that. So between the two of them, in our family, we believe we were capable of doing anything that we chose to do.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that if we encountered resistance or someone in our way, you would find a way around or over that.
Mm-hmm.
We believe we could succeed if we just kept trying.
Well, your parents sound like they instilled, you know, a confidence and a strength in you and your siblings. And I want to talk a little bit more about that. So in your book, I guess it's your second book, you talk about how your mom worked really hard to keep you and your family on schedule. Your dad was TDY while you guys were in Germany, and you had really no idea what he was doing. It was kind of a hush-hush thing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that Thanksgiving where your mom kind of just held you all together or else?
Yes. We were in Germany.
Mm.
And we were there just before the Berlin Wall went up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of tension between Russia, the United States, and some of the other countries
mm-hmm.
that had been assigned areas in Germany. My dad went on a maneuver,
mm-hmm.
could not tell us where he was going, and could not tell us when he would return. He did that twice during a month and a half. And the maneuver he went on just before Thanksgiving, he left in the middle of the night, and we had no idea when he would be coming back. My mom was separated from her source of strength, mm-hmm. which was usually her relative,
mm-hmm.
because we couldn't call on the telephone.
Right.
You know, you couldn't just call someone from overseas and talk to them for half an hour.
Right.
It was too expensive and difficult.
Yeah.
We didn't have Facebook. We didn't have Twitter. And letters took a long time to send and receive.
Uh-huh.
So my mom didn't have the normal strength that she would have had, which would have been her relatives who supported her.
Mm-mm.
She held us together by helping us with our homework, mm-hmm. helping us with our assignments,
mm-mm.
and by playing games with us. She was a big, big proponent of word games. Mm-hmm. We used to play rhyming games. Anything that rhymed with the word say, way, may.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped a lot because my mom wrote poetry.
Oh.
And was later published. She's published two small books of poetry. So we learned to write poetry, and that's how I started on my writing career myself. I wrote poetry in the middle school, in high school, and in college, in the local yearbook,
mm-hmm.
And in the college anthologies.
Well, that segues into my next question. I guess you've always been a writer, starting with poetry, but what compelled you to decide to write your memoirs? And give us the names of the books again.
Okay. The book title is A Look Back in Time.
Okay.
Memoir of a Military Kid in the 50s.
Okay.
It's a book series of four books.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to write the book as a way of sharing the family history with the other members of the family.
Mm-hmm.
I realized as I wrote book one and started on book two that the stories were universal. They're stories about being a child in a world much of which you don't understand and much of which is changing as you grow up. But it's a kid's story, and it's a story of coming into your own as a teenager and then as an adult, and all the things that you had to learn to succeed and to become better at being a better person and better at being more competitive in the world. So I wrote those two books, and I'm in the process of writing book three, which will be about Walton, Oklahoma, and my time I spent there in high school. Those books have been a source of inspiration to me and others who've read them because they tell the story of what it's like to be a black kid in America and in Europe. And I think it would be interesting to people who, at this point in time, would like to know what that was like.
Well, so two quick questions. And the first one is, so what was the difference about being a black kid in America and being a black kid in Germany? And then the second question is, do mostly military kids buy your book? I mean, military brats or veterans buy them, or is it just a universal, everybody in buys them?
Okay, as for question one, being a black kid in Germany was a really awesome experience. Most Germans in the 50s had not seen African Americans. If they had, these were military soldiers. And so there were some kids, but there weren't that many. So we were a source of curiosity. But I loved the approach that German kids took. Their curiosity was to learn everything about America. They wanted to know everything we knew about America. So it wasn't a curiosity about us being black. The curiosity was about us being American. So I learned that a African American in Europe is an American. What I learned about an African American in America is that there are two classes of Americans. Those who believe that the rights that were put in the Constitution were for them, and that others can live here, but they don't necessarily get all those rights. And those who came here, many enslaved, and whose parents and great-grandparents worked their way into a better life and believe that the Constitution says those rights accrue to everyone born on American soil. And for the second question, who buys my books? I've sold a lot of books to military brats and military veterans and what you call essential people, people who are working people. However, the book appeals to all groups, to all ages. It's a universal story of childhood. And if you or anyone else wants to take a trip through your own childhood, you'll find yourself, when you're reading the book, doing just that.
Well, that's good to know. We're going to definitely put the information on the bottom of our podcast so that people can find, you know, your website. So why don't you tell us right now where they can find out more about you and about your books?
Okay, you can find my books at any bookstore if you ask, and online. Again, if you put in my full name, Bernard N. Lee Jr., and if you ask for the title, A Look Back in Time, Memoir of a Military Kid in the 50s, I have a website, www.bernardlee.com. B as in Bravo, ernardlee junior.com. So it's www.bernardleejr.com.
Okay.
And you can also purchase the book on the website.
Okay, very good. Looking back at your childhood and growing up in the 60s, what parallels are you seeing between then and now?
There are parallels. As in the 50s and now, progress comes slowly, but it does come. Good people of conscience can make a difference, and you can see with the variety and diversity of people who are marching today, mm-hmm. that's true. That's true today, and it was true back in the 50s and in the 60s when Dr. Martin Luther King marched. Mm-hmm. He marched with Catholics and Jews. He marched with African Americans and Asians and Latinos. He marched with all groups of people back in the 60s, and that's true today. So good people of conscience can make a difference. Your talents and self-determination help you discover and succeed. So the most important thing an individual can know about today mm-hmm. versus yesterday mm-hmm. is that if you have a talent, if you work hard to discover that gift or talent, mm-hmm. if you cultivate that talent with hard work and study and applying yourself, you can trust me. You will be recognized, you will be discovered, and you have every chance, like everyone else in the country of America, to succeed. Without obstacles, going around obstacles, going through and over obstacles, determination is the difference. Find your talent and press on.
Well, that sounds like a really good message to give the 2020 high school graduates that are just now, you know, starting their journey into this pandemic and this tumultuous time. Do you feel hopeful that things are going to be better from here on?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I've lived 75 years, and so I've seen difficult times. Mm. I lived when the effects of the depression from the 20s and the 30s mm-hmm. kept everyone in a soup line, mm-hmm. in a bread line. Mm-hmm. I lived through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s when we sat in long lines just to get gasoline. Mm-hmm. So I've been through those turmoil. This is a difficult time for many. We haven't even gotten into the worst of it. There are going to be a lot of people unemployed. People are going to lose their homes, their cars, their jobs, and they're going to need all the help they can get from good people of good conscience who have the means to help. So I'm optimistic. I believe not only in the future of America, but I believe in the future of those who care about others, and I believe we'll be just fine.
Well, that's a very hopeful note to end our conversation on, Bernard. I want to thank you for your insight and your sharing your stories today with us and our listeners. Any last things you'd like to say before we wrap it up?
You can connect with me on Facebook mm-hmm. at Bernard, N as in November, Lee, L-E-E, JR. If you put that into Facebook, you'll get my website, you can like it, and then you can follow along as I write book 3.
Okay, well, we'll add that to the podcast bottom. So, again, this has been Circe Olson-Westner, and I have had the great pleasure of speaking with military brat, veteran, and author, award-winning author, Bernard Lee, in our special series of podcasts, Colorblind. Thank you so much for joining us, Bernard.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.